Hello, this is Beatrice Pavia with part one of the pantograph of Friday, November 7th, 2025. We turn first to page one, where the main story is actually just some beautiful photos, views at the zoo, sunny fall day, a perfect time to make and renew memories at Miller Park Landmark. And there's a photograph of some flamingos soaking up the sunny weather, and the caption reads, Tom Miller of Castle Pines, Colorado, and his sister, Pat Miller of Westmont, check out the snow leopard on Thursday, October 6, 2025, at Miller Park Zoo in Bloomington. The siblings, who have memories of visiting the zoo when they were younger and living in Normal, stopped by while in town visiting another sister. And our first story from page one is about business. Headlined, Rivian sees gains and setbacks. Company eyes R2 as key to growth in the changing market. This story is from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Electric vehicle maker Rivian had a busy third quarter, one that could prove pivotal for the startup and its promised Georgia projects. From July to September, the California-based automaker held a ceremonial groundbreaking for its $5 billion Georgia factory and signed a lease for an East Coast headquarters along the Beltline in Atlanta. Rivian currently builds all of its pickup trucks, SUVs, and commercial delivery vans in Normal, where it has continued to expand, and plans to manufacture its new model, the much-anticipated R2. The company on Tuesday released its financial results for the quarter, featuring growth in revenue, but also in its quarterly losses. But the company said it is laser-focused on preparing next year's expected launch of the new model. We look forward to 2026 and remain steadfast in our belief that R2 and our technology roadmap will be truly transformative for our growth and profitability, Claire McDonough, Rivian's chief financial officer, said on a third quarter investor call. The fourth quarter is also shaping up to be pivotal for Rivian, which announced a large round of layoffs last month and is grappling with a fast-changing EV demand landscape after federal consumer tax credits were revoked. Here's what you need to know about the company's third quarter. Financial stakes. Rivian's balance sheet includes increases across the board, a sharp uptick in revenue, but also expanded losses. During the third quarter, Rivian posted total revenue of $1.6 billion, a 78% increase from the same time in 2024. The automaker also posted a loss of nearly $1.2 billion, a 6% increase from the same time last year. The automaker ended September with nearly $7.1 billion in cash, cash equivalents, and short-term investments, about $349 million more than a year ago. Rivian's reserves are bolstered by a joint software venture worth an estimated $5.8 billion with German auto giant Volkswagen. McDonough said Rivian expects to receive $2 billion from that partnership next year. The automaker delivered 13,201 vehicles during the third quarter, the most of any quarter this year. EV demand spiked across the industry as consumers capitalized on federal tax credits worth up to $7,500 before they expired at the end of September. Rivian expects deliveries to decrease in the fourth quarter. Rivian adjusted the guidance for how many vehicles it expects to deliver in 2025, the second time this year it has altered that figure. The company said it now expects to deliver between 41,500 to 43,500 vehicles, while the company started the year aiming for up to 51,000 deliveries. In addition, Rivian has had several quarters in prior years where it delivered more vehicles, peaking 2 years ago with 15,564 deliveries. The lack of steady growth for Rivian's flagship and more expensive R1 pickup truck and SUV models is why company leaders say the forthcoming launch of the more affordable R2 is the automaker's best chance to capture mass market appeal. During the third quarter, Rivian produced 10,720 vehicles at its Seoul factory in Normal. It is an increase from the second quarter, but less than many quarters in 2023 and 24. The factory underwent a 1.1 million square foot expansion to prepare for R2 manufacturing, which company leaders said partially led to lower production figures than prior quarters. Executives also cited tariff impacts on supply chains. R2 will launch in the first half of 2026, and the Normal factory will have an annual R2 capacity of up to 155,000 units. At a starting price point of $45,000, R2 will be below the average new vehicle purchase price, which is $50,000. We are really bullish and really confident on R2 and what that represents for us as a business, Rivian CEO RJ Scaringe said on the call. The bet on R2's popularity is fueling Rivian's decision to move forward with its planned $5 billion Georgia factory. Rivian officials and state leaders, including Governor Brian Kemp, held a ceremonial groundbreaking in September on the nearly 2,000-acre site in southern Morgan and Walton counties. Vertical construction will begin next year, according to Rivian. The Georgia factory is expected to be built in two phases, each with a total manufacturing capacity of 200,000 vehicles. R2s, alongside a smaller variant called R3, are expected to start rolling off assembly lines by 2028. Scaringe said there are plans to export some of the Georgia factory's output through the Peach State's ports. We have not announced European timing yet, but it's a really core part of the program, he said. It was also a key element to the decision that we made to set up the plant in Georgia, given its ease of export for vehicles going to Europe. At the same time, Rivian finalized its lease for its East Coast headquarters in Atlanta along the Beltline. The office project was announced in mid-July and will employ about 100 workers by the end of 2025, with plans for up to 500 jobs. Our next front page story is about the courts. Headlined, Teen Gets 30 Years for Murder. Monroy admits stabbing man after argument at 2023 birthday party. This story is datelined Bloomington. An 18-year-old has been sentenced to 30 years in prison after he pleaded guilty to fatally stabbing a teen from Normal. Luis A. Monroy of Bloomington has been detained for the last 2 years after he was accused of killing 19-year-old Nicholas M. Zapata following an argument at a birthday party on September 23, 2023. Monroy was 16 at the time of the offense, but he was charged as an adult with 4 counts of first-degree murder. He had pleaded guilty in March but retracted this plea in May when he requested a public defender after his private attorney withdrew in the midst of plea negotiations. During a pretrial hearing Wednesday, Assistant State's Attorney Ashley Scarborough and Assistant Public Defender Matthew Butler told Judge Jason Chambers they had reached an agreement. Monroy pleaded guilty to 1 count of murder, and the remaining 3 counts were dismissed by the prosecution pursuant to the plea agreement. Chambers advised the defendant of his rights and explained the sentencing range for a murder conviction. The state and defense agreed to a sentence of 30 years in the Department of Corrections, followed by 3 years of mandatory supervised release. Monroy is also required to register on the state's registry of convicted murderers. He earned credit for 774 days already served in custody. In a prepared statement, State's Attorney Erica Reynolds said because Monroy was under 21 at the time of the offense, he will be eligible for parole after 20 years under Illinois law. While nothing we do in court can reduce the trauma the victim's family and friends have experienced as a result of the events on September 23rd, we hope that this resolution brings them some peace, she said. During Wednesday's hearing, Scarborough said if the case had gone to trial, the state would have presented evidence that would prove Monroy had murdered Zapata on September 23, 2023. She said the altercation between the two had started with an argument at the party. Two girls who witnessed the fight told police the argument fizzled and Zapata walked away. But then Monroy asked one girl to choose between him and the victim. When she would not choose, Monroy chased Zapata, tackled him, and pinned him to the ground before stabbing him four times in the chest. Both witnesses told police Monroy had told them not to call 911 before running away. Bloomington police responded to the scene shortly after 10 p.m. and found Zapata with multiple stab wounds. A pocket knife was found on the ground beside him with mud on the blade and blood on the handle, prosecutors previously said. Zapata was taken to Carl Broman Medical Center where he was pronounced dead. His cause of death was multiple stab wounds, with the majority of the stab wounds being to the left lung and heart, Scarborough said. Bloomington police found and arrested Monroy a couple hours after they were dispatched. A witness reported seeing Monroy in Hayworth carrying bloodied clothes in a bag. Monroy took a photo of the clothes before throwing them into a fire pit, Scarborough said. After they found Monroy, officers found the clothes, which had been destroyed in the fire, and in an extraction of the defendant's cell phone, they found the photo, she said. Bobby Zapata, father of the victim, took the stand Wednesday to give the first victim impact statement, dressed in a purple shirt and a matching purple tie. In previous interviews with the Pantograph, Bobby Zapata said his son's favorite color was purple. Traces of purple marked half of the courtroom, full of Zapata's family and friends in tears during Wednesday's hearing. On September 23, 2023, my firstborn son was murdered. On that day, that night, my entire world stopped, Bobby Zapata said, beginning his statement. Ever since then, my wife and I live in a fog of pain that does not lift, Bobby Zapata said. We have become masters of pretending, putting on fake smiles. He told Monroy he not only took his son's life that night, but also the lives of Nicholas's father, mother, stepmother, stepfather, siblings, extended family, and friends. He had a heart so big for this world, too big, he said. Nicholas Zapata's mother, Elizabeth Bain, echoed Bobby Zapata's words when she took the stand next. I was blessed to have been loved by Nicholas and to have loved him for the short 19 years that he blessed this earth, she said, holding an urn of her son's ashes wrapped in a blue bow tie. Bain recalled finding out what had happened to her son, explaining the sheer panic that consumed her. He was a kind and gentle soul, wise beyond his years, she said. Bain described her son as loyal, loving, brave, kind, athletic, smart, and funny. The list goes on, she said. Now all that light and potential is left to the ashes in this urn. Nicholas Zapata's parents described awaiting closure in this case as a grueling experience and said no sentence and no amount of years could equate to the life that was lost. I want Luis Alexander Monroy to know exactly what he has done, said Bobby Zapata. He didn't just end a life, he destroyed a family. I want him to feel that weight every single day. I want him to wake up haunted by the memory of the boy that he murdered. Monroy's mother interrupted Bobby Zapata's statement when he spoke about the 18-year-old, shouting at him to stop. My heart is broken too, she said. When Bain took the stand, she described the pain she feels as a mother, saying she hopes no mother has to go through what she has, including Monroy's. She told the court about Nicholas Zapata's character and his ability to form friendships with everybody. She said he would have even been friends with Monroy. You are guilty of taking such a bright light, she told Monroy. A third victim impact statement was submitted to the court but not read aloud. In closing the hearing, Chambers said, I hope for those who are here, you are able to find peace. And our last front page story is the Cutting Board column titled Mad Jack Ventures to Create Pastrami. Challenges are inevitable. Risks are a key component in the game of life. We only get to punch one ticket. Sometimes you just have to throw better judgment to the wind, trust in your skills, and spend more than you budgeted on a slab of beef brisket from Costco. I think it was around $70. But you know what, dagnabbit, I think it actually worked. Throw on your lab coats and let out a good old-fashioned cackle a la 1931 Frankenstein, because Mad Jack's made some pastrami. I'd never portioned a brisket before this. Any time I bought one, it was already broken down. Thankfully, earlier this year, John Solberg of the Brass Pig's Smoke and Ale House invited me to see how he trims brisket there. They sell a lot of it, so I'd say he knows pretty well how to cut it up with minimal waste. This process really does require a sharp knife, dexterity, and plenty of counter space. I am not as skilled as John, so I recommended watching the video on our website. I got four things out of my 12-pound brisket: two roasts, a bunch of scraps to make ground beef, and some clean fat to render into beef tallow. I don't like to waste. Cast your minds back 2 weeks ago, and you'll recall a little bit of our conversation on food preservation. Pastrami likely traces its origins to Central Eurasia in regions surrounding the Black Sea, like modern-day Turkey, Bulgaria, and Romania, according to Ted Merwin, author of Pastrami on Rye, An Overstuffed History of the Jewish Deli. Side note, I have recently finished my annual rereading of Dracula, and it is now in my mind that the Count and his subjects feasted on that type of meal while he was still human. Two classic horror references in one column. In order to preserve food, horse riders in Eurasia would tie slabs of meat underneath the sides of their saddles while riding, thus tenderizing and salting the meat with the horse's sweat, according to Merwin. Thank goodness, and the health department, that we improved to soaking meat in a briny solution to preserve it. This is a common method for preserving all kinds of meat, including ham, corned beef, and pastrami, which is a corned beef with a few more steps. That word, corn, is actually an old English term that meant granulated, like the grains of salt used in the curing brine. To get corned beef, we need a blend of spices and a special kind of salt referred to as either curing salt number one or Prague powder number one. There are products called curing salt number two or Prague powder number two, and these are used differently. Number one is used for quick cures like ham and corned beef, while number two is used for long cures like salami. You can order Prague powder number one online or purchase it at Bloomington Spice Works, located at 311 North Main Street. Many stores sell a blend of pickling spices that includes bay leaves, peppercorns, mustard seeds, coriander, allspice berries, and cloves, generally, but I have all of those things in my kitchen, so I did not need to purchase them. Kosher salt and sugar are also needed for the brine. The ingredients are combined with water and heated until the salt and sugar dissolve completely. And then once the brine is cooled, the meat is submerged fully and cured for a number of days. After the necessary time, the meat is removed, rinsed thoroughly, and cooked. Corned beef is usually braised or boiled, while pastrami is further spiced and smoked. Both processes are low and slow and should result in a flavorful, tender, and meaty feast. I will include an ingredients list for a recipe from the New York Times, I subscribe, written by Florence Fabricant, that I used as a guide, but I have some notes on it. This recipe from La Boite in New York calls for 4.5 tablespoons of smoked salt, 2/3 cups kosher salt, and 4 teaspoons Prague powder number one for a 4 to 5 pound brisket. The pastrami is cured, spiced, and then cooked for 12 hours in a 200 degree Fahrenheit oven. The smoked salt adds smoke flavor without the need of a smoker, which I liked, but smoked salt is a niche item. You can find it at Spiceworks, but adding liquid smoke to the brine is easier and more accessible, in my opinion, not to mention cheaper. Next, whenever I'm using curing salt, I like to measure by weight instead of volume. There's this great source at eatcuredmeat.com that will calculate how much salt you need for a specific recipe. It's a little bit more technical than the Times' recipe, but I think it's important to use precision with curing salt. Unfortunately, and because I'm a fool, I did not pay attention to the calculator's sea salt weight and stuck with the volume measurements listed above in kosher salt, roughly 1 1/4 cups. I found this made a product that was just a bit too salty, to be honest. After brining, you can soak the meat in clean water for a few hours to reduce the saltiness. Next time, because I will be making this again, I will stick to using the calculator and measuring salt by weight. Anyway, I cured the brisket in my fridge for 2 weeks, softly whispering to it at night, "My own, my precious." After a fortnight, I rinsed it clean and let it hang out in the fridge, uncovered, another night. Then I ground 3 tablespoons of peppercorns with 1 tablespoon of mustard seeds, mixed in some garlic and onion powder, and coated the brisket. Then at 9 p.m., I set the oven to 200 degrees Fahrenheit. The brisket came out the next morning. I wrapped it in foil and let it hang out for 4 hours before putting it in the fridge. At 5 p.m., I grabbed a long, sharp knife and sliced it up. On its own, this pastrami is a touch salty, but nowhere near unpleasant, let alone inedible. We heated some slices up in the oven and made our pastrami on rye sandwiches with pickled onion and mustard. This is meaty, well-spiced, and makes a heck of a sandwich. It's just too bad nobody at the office asked me to bring it in. Don't be afraid to take risks, my friends. That's it for the second season of The Cutting Board. I'll see you next time. And here is the ingredients for a no-smoker pastrami from La Boite. 4 to 5 pound brisket, either the point or the flat. 4.5 tablespoons smoked salt. 2/3 cup kosher salt. 1/2 cup granulated sugar. 1/2 cup brown sugar. 4 teaspoons Prague powder number 1. 2 bay leaves, 6 garlic cloves, 3 cloves, 1 tablespoon crushed black peppercorns, 1 teaspoon crushed allspice, 5 tablespoons crushed coriander seeds, 3 tablespoons black mustard seeds, and 1/2 cup coarse ground black pepper. And we turn now to some local and state news. Here are some news briefs. As the federal government remains closed after more than a month, air passengers at Central Illinois Regional Airport have not seen any significant delays, officials said. As of now, we have not had any operations affected by the shutdown, said Melissa Beavers, marketing and communications manager for the airport, in a phone call Wednesday. The airport's 36 or so Transportation Security Administration officers have missed 2 paychecks now, but they are still coming to work and completing their duties, Beavers said. In fact, passengers have been offering words of encouragement and empathy as they go through security checks, she added. Air traffic at the airport, however, has not been hindered, she said. We have a contract with a private company, so our air traffic controllers are not affected by the shutdown, she said. The airport is served by Allegiant, American, and Delta Airlines, with nonstop destinations in Atlanta, Chicago, Dallas-Fort Worth, Orlando-Sanford, and Tampa-St. Petersburg year-round. And a database to tell Route 66 history. Dateline Springfield. As part of the 100th anniversary of Route 66 in 2026, the Illinois State Museum has launched an online database of 100 oral histories about the Mother Road. The Route 66 Oral History Project database includes video-recorded interviews as well as word-searchable written transcriptions, according to a news release. Contributors include people who lived, worked, and traveled along Route 66 during its pre-interstate days, as well as individuals who promote, preserve, and interpret for future generations. After a revival of interest in the late 20th century, Route 66 has evolved into a popular road trip route, drawing millions of visitors from around the world each year. This project was made possible through the support of the Illinois State Museum Society and a grant from the National Park Service's Route 66 Corridor Preservation Program. For more information, visit illinoisstatemuseum.org or make a trip to the museum, which is located at 502 South Spring Street in Springfield. And Bloomington sets leaf collection. Fall leaf collection for Bloomington residents kicked off this week and will run through the end of the year, weather permitting. Crews will be moving throughout the city with leaf vacuums and brush equipment to collect loose piles of leaves behind the curb. Leaves piled on the street will not be collected and can block storm drains, cause sewer backups, and encourage kids to play in traffic, city officials said in a news release. Leaf piles should be no more than 3 feet high and should not be placed in biodegradable bags, trash cans, or other containers. Brush, garden trimmings, pumpkins, bulk waste, and other debris should be kept separate from leaves. For more information and to view an interactive map of leaf collection in Bloomington, you can visit the city's website at bloomingtonil.gov. And Missouri man sentenced for drugs and weapons. A man from Blackjack, Missouri, has been sentenced to 5 years in prison as the third and final defendant in a McLean County drug and weapon case. Kuteris J. Thompson, 19, appeared before Judge Jason Chambers on Monday, November 3rd, for a pretrial hearing during which he entered a guilty plea. Initially, Thompson was charged, along with two others, Markel A. Wooten, 24, and Aubrey J. Coleman, 36, both of St. Louis. Each man faced the following charges: 2 counts of armed violence, Class X felonies, 1 count of unlawful possession of 500 to 2,000 grams of cannabis with intent to deliver, a Class 2 felony, 1 count of unlawful possession of 500 to 2,000 grams of cannabis, a Class 3 felony, and 1 count of unlawful possession of a weapon, a Class 3 felony. Thompson pleaded guilty Monday to unlawful possession of 500 to 2,000 grams of cannabis with intent to deliver, and a newly added charge of aggravated unlawful possession of a weapon by a person younger than 21. The remaining charges were dismissed. He was sentenced to 5 years on the cannabis charge and 3 years on the weapon charge to be served concurrently to one another at 50% and followed by 6 months of mandatory supervised release. Wooten pleaded guilty in September and Coleman pleaded guilty in August to the same cannabis offense and an unlawful use of weapons offense. Each man was sentenced to 5 years. Assistant State's Attorney Jeffrey Horvay represented the state during Monday's hearing, and Brendan Bukowski represented Thompson. Bukowski could not be reached for comment Wednesday afternoon. And here is today's Flick Fact question. At last count, there are 5,619 high schools in Illinois, both public and private. Can you name the oldest high school of them all in Illinois? Hint, it is not in the Chicago area. And the answer is, it is Peoria Central, now 169 years old, founded in 1856. And this has been Beatrice Pavia with part one of the Pantagraph of Friday, November 7th, 2025. I look forward to reading part two with you next.